Hi, I'm Konstantinos Komaitis.
And I'm Jillian York.
And this is the Internet of Humans. Today, we welcome Chris Riley, a global internet policy and technology executive. Chris spent 7 years as the director for public policy at Mozilla, and he's a former Internet Freedom Program Manager at the U.S. Department of State. He's currently a senior fellow for internet governance at the AR Institute. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to see you both and talk to you both today.
It's great to have you. So I'm going to just dive right into it. As I was trying to find some info to introduce you, I came across something interesting, and that's where I'd like us to start today. So on your LinkedIn profile, you say, I work at the intersection of internet policy, law, and technology, motivated by the belief that an open, disruptive internet delivers tremendous socioeconomic benefits, and that if we, as a global society, don't work to protect and preserve the internet's core features, those benefits will go away. The internet ecosystem isn't perfect, but we have to be smart in how we address its problems and continue to invest in
strengths. I love that.
Me too. And that's...
I've had it up for years. I'm glad you feel the same way about it. I just can't touch it. I look at it every couple of years and I'm like,
I love that.
Nope,
and I have to just throw a little, like, you and Catherine Marr have probably had this conversation. Yeah.
No, I don't think so, but I guess we should. But it wouldn't surprise me that she feels the same way.
I think she does, but we'll have her on another time.
And I think that all three of us more or less feel the same way. So I would let's talk a little bit about the internet before we go into the specific issues around the internet. So for you, what are the internet's core features? And is the internet as disruptive as it once was?
It's an existential question for me. The internet has to be disruptive, otherwise I would say it's not the internet. Because I do think that the sort of innate capacity for self-disruption is a part of it. And I think back a lot about some of the narratives that were spun around Steve Jobs, Apple, and how he was willing to sort of upend the theory of classical creative disruption and cannibalize his own markets through new devices when he rolled out the iPod and the iPad and so forth, even knowing that those would disrupt the market for the established tablet. But I'm not trying to turn this into pure economic theory or anything weird like that. For me, the internet is you can look at it from the technical lens, but I prefer to look at it from the people lens. It's a way that people connect with each other, that people can organize, that people can build things, that people can do things. I'm fond of defining the internet in contrast. So the internet is not television, because it is not a sort of produced one-to-many content distribution platform, though it certainly has television features in it. It's not a telephone, because it's not just connecting small groups. There's a place where things live and live in perpetuity that is more than that. It's all of these things together, and it's a way that people can communicate. I also tend to talk a lot about the internet in the market sense. So from a sort of a more economics or a business perspective, what distinguishes the internet to me is its relatively low costs of market entry. What that means, to back away from the econ speak, is that it is very easy, relatively speaking, to create something new and to make it available to millions of people almost instantly and to make a business out of it. And that's the kind of dynamic that we've never seen before. I mean, it's as revolutionary as the printing press. This is not a new assertion. Lots of people have said things like this. But in the same way, the printing press went from taking written work that was one person's to handwrite and to distribute and to spread around, the internet has taken one person's business that had to be slowly built and just magnified it onto new levels and new dimensions. And so a lot of the conversations and sort of policy issues that we're having, I think, speak to whether we want to and can help the internet stay that engine of incredible low-cost creation.
Interesting. And I like the fact that, you know, you're departing a little bit from the technology and you make it more about humans and it's perfect for a podcast, right?
Yeah. I mean, we could talk about the technology layer as well. I mean, it's a, you know, but we don't need to, I don't need to go down that rabbit hole today.
Yeah, no, I mean, let's talk a little bit more about disruption. I mean, for a long time, we've been experiencing the internet as a kind of service company, Facebook for social networking, Google for search, et cetera, now Amazon for commerce, you get the idea. These companies were once disruptors taking advantage of the internet's core features, but now they're, I mean, I don't know if anybody saw Adam Mosseri's tweets this week, but they seem like they're going out of their way to eliminate any disruption. How can we get out of this situation?
I mean, no one is going to promise that they have the right answer to that, though there are lots of theories. I would say, just looking back a little bit, the reason why I tend to embrace the disruptive label as strongly as I do, even though here in California, Disrupt has become a bit tarnished as a brand for the internet, right? Disrupt is not mean disrupt anymore. It means a big, flashy, fancy conference in downtown San Francisco with the same people driving the same Teslas to talk about the same things from year after year with the shiniest new gadgets. Disruption is about power, right? And where does power lie? And how can we ensure that power is fairly well distributed? And the some of the tension points that we're seeing in the ecosystem now are, yes, companies have accumulated a lot more power, both individually and collectively, than they once had. Governments are trying to claw it back now. And I wrote just a couple old things that I wrote that I think are relevant to this. One was a paper in a special edition of IEEE Computing Magazine on censorship and control. It was called Anarchy, State or Utopia, Checks and Balances of Power and Internet Governance. And in that, I articulated a theory that I still very strongly believe, which is that we need to think about balance and we need to view power and the internet as a complex system and look at levers and how we can adjust levers and the kind of chaotic effect that shifting a lever can have on the power as it's held by governments, by companies, by users, and sort of not by individual companies, but by markets as a whole. So to me, when you see concentrations of power that seem like they are too much within an individual company, I look a lot to markets as the answer to that. And so how do we fashion levers of market to create opportunities for lots of different kinds of competition, innovation, rewards for investment, and so forth? I also look to users and how can we empower users to have a true choice, a true ability to move with their feet in the classical competition sense, and to make their voice and their perspective and power heard in this context.
So there's a lot of things there that I would like us to unpack. I mean, this is, and I will start with this.
That's also only one of my two old papers, but I'll get to the other one later.
We'll link those for listeners.
Perfect. Yes, absolutely. No, it's fine. No problem.
No, because these papers are also very important. And, you know, those things are very important, especially the way things are currently, where literally everywhere you turn around the world, you're seeing some form of regulation. And some of that regulation is disruptive in its own unique way.
Yes, but we'll absolutely. Talk a little bit. Not the good kind of disruption. Sometimes the good, right? but often the bad. Yeah.
Exactly. And we can talk about that a little bit down the road. But I want to touch on one of the things that I know you care about, but I also believe that there's something in it, and I'm trying really to wrap my head around it in many ways. So one of the things that you and I have been talking for sure, and I've seen you write about, is how we can use government as a tool to increase internet user agency and control in an effective way, right?
Yes. Now,
user agency, of course, is not new. It has been part of the discussions for the past 10, 20 years, but it is gaining again traction, especially with Web3 applications and our favorite, NFTs.
NFTs.
Exactly. Yeah. But with agency, at least from where I'm coming from, there's always seem to be the same problem. In order to have agency, you need to have choice, right? And currently, going back to what we're discussing about disruption and about all these companies, I don't see that there is so much choice. So do you think that governments can fix this, or how can we go to a place where users are experiencing real agency? What is your mindset on that?
I want to answer that, but first, for those who aren't already where we are and convinced that user agency is something to be concerned about right now, I'd love to dig into a little bit more about why user agency is a challenge right now, and that'll help inform the ways that we can think about trying to make it better. I very strongly believe that the reason we're having the so-called tech lash right now, the reason there's been so much unhappiness and public distrust and discontent with the technology experiences we have is both a sort of perceived and actual loss of user agency with respect to these services, right? There's sort of no, it was sort of inevitable that we would get to this point. As services got more and more complicated, as we operated from what has proved to be a, I'll put it diplomatically, very limited notice and choice paradigm for user control over data and data access policies and so forth, we were inevitably going to get to the point where the way that users were given agency was complicated systems of checkboxes and very long terms of service that nobody's going to read and that will never give anybody the feeling that they have a meaningful choice of what kinds of experiences there are, no matter how many companies there are, right? So it's something more than just the number of companies that are around. It's something deeper than that and something that needs us to feel like the way that data is being presented to us is within our control. So another way that I talk about this a lot, there is a vast, vast ocean of data within the internet, right? This vast ocean is far more than we have any means of navigating by ourselves. We remember that those of us, I think we're all in this camp, of a certain age, remember those early Comcast cable modem ads where someone was browsing and they got to the end of the internet because they had such fast access that they could get to everything, right? That is not even funny, that joke anymore, because there's obviously too much of an ocean of information for us to navigate on our own. So we depend on that layer that sits between us and that ocean of information, that layer of presentation algorithms, recommendation engines, recommendation systems, filters, not just filters in the remove content set, but in the prioritization sense. So that like incredible obtuse black box of machine learning that so many different companies, really, I think every company to some level or another will have to do this at some point, will use to be our intermediary between us and that ocean of information. But we can't see how that works. We can't understand how that works. And we have very limited or no ability to go in and change how that layer works. So that's the agency gap that I see and why I believe people feel like they're sort of having content shoved down their throats or, and I hate this term, having things shadow banned that they're trying to put out into the world. It's a lack of perception of that layer in between us and the ocean of information.
Okay, and do you think that, how can I put this, user agency can actually be the factor that could shift this balance and create, and give more power to users?
Yeah.
But who's going to give that power? Is it going to be through regulation, you feel? I mean, how are users going to regain that power?
Yeah, thank you. And I'm sorry, I dropped the first part of your question there, which is about the role of government. I do think that there is a role for government in here. I'd like to believe that there are ways that we can build global policy solutions without the need for nation state level regulators, because as we have all written about, all three of us at least, there are concerning dimensions and trends and outcomes of individual nation state government intervention to try to achieve even good intentioned outcomes. But I do think that regulation, additional regulation will be necessary. Maybe not. Maybe we won't need additional regulation as we watch the Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act from Europe, which are basically done now. I mean, those are a pretty powerful wave. So we'll have to see the effects of those, both good and bad, before we can really conclude that a lot more is necessary. But I suspect that more will be necessary. So that's the role of government as I see it in this landscape. And obviously, as always, the devil is in the details when it comes to regulations and how you try to optimize them to reach good outcomes and minimize bad. The user agency via technology piece is one that I've been writing about a lot with a co-author, Dick Riesman, on Tech Policy Press. So our series starts with this frame of delegation, and these are all very complex, long pieces, 2,500 to 4,000 words each, and we're at three, and we've got a fourth in progress, so it's almost a book already in and of itself. But the centerpiece of our thesis is, like democracy, you want to give power to people, but you also want to construct levels above that, like representative democracy, where they can sort of organize and centralize and delegate the power that they are given into other forces. And I'm totally off in an abstract rabbit hole here. Forgive me for a little bit. But from a technological perspective, the idea here is to avoid that millions of boxes and obtusely long terms of service and privacy problems, and think about ways that we can encourage the emergence of an ecosystem or a new market of intermediaries that work on behalf of users, sort of more direct agent for the user-based responsibilities. And now it sounds like I'm talking about science fiction rather than the universe of technology we have today. Forgive me for that.
No. I really want to follow up on this and ask you.
Yeah.
Okay, so we do have questions that we've written out, and I'm going to come to that, KK.
Yeah.
But I got to say, where does this fit in terms of like Fukushima's idea of, I forget what he calls it, middleware.
Fukuyama's
how
middleware
does this
idea.
Mesh with
yeah,
middleware?
There's a lot of overlap.
Okay.
There's a lot of overlap there. Yeah, I think that it depends on which iteration of that you're reading. Some of those involve platforms directly giving more control and more levers into the users to control the recommendation engines and layers. I think there's some possibility there as well. Some of the earlier middleware writings speak very specifically to creating a new layer like this, a new market like this that would be empowered. So I think there are a few different people and circles of scholars that have been working on variants of this for a few years now, which I would argue is a sort of a validation of the possibilities of the model in and of itself. But different people emphasize different pieces of it when they write about it. But I view what Fukuyama and the Stanford team have been written about as being very much in the same camp. Same with Mike Masnick's Protocols Not Platforms. Same with some of the other things that are being advocated for in the space. Yeah, this idea of empowering individuals to take more agency over their internet and information experience mm-hmm. by means of using a series of third parties, that is gaining some traction through a lot of different perspectives.
Yeah,
and
this is what Cory Doctorow has been pushing this a lot as well through EFF.
Absolutely.
Sorry, Konstantinos, do you?
Yes, can I go there? Because I really have to
go
ask.
Go for it.
Do we really believe, however, this all sounds great. And all the people, you know, Mike and Cory and, you know, I just love them. And I really agree
with them.
We're
going to have Cory on at some point.
Yeah, exactly. We should actually. But I cannot help but wonder how feasible this is, right? Because governments,
yeah.
they say that actually they're doing everything for the users,
yeah.
but I have serious objections about how many of the policies that we're currently seeing are for the users.
Can I comment on this real quick and just say that I think that part of what is going on with governments, and I'm saying this in my kindest self, for those of you who know me, I think that, you know, people who make government policies have very split brains. They're thinking about so many different things at once. They're thinking about all sorts of policies that have nothing to do with the internet. And so the internet is a backdrop to all of it. It's an underpinning, but it's not their primary focus. And so they're not always going to see the big picture. And I think that that's why we see the flaws that we see. And, you know, they, like, in a perfect world, maybe governance would look different than it does. But people, you know, the people making the laws don't have the time to needle into the details that Chris does.
I think that's right. And let me just call out an example of that sort of tension point as it appears within public policy conversations, right? It's whether you're looking at the outcomes or the impact of a public policy proposal from the perspective of an individual user, from the perspective of an individual company, be it a competitor or an established large company, a country, usually your own, sort of nation state level wars. We see this tension a lot, and we're seeing it a lot in the international internet policy space right now as well, right? As cyber attacks and cyber warfare and foreign disinformation campaigns continue to sort of go spinning up and seem relatively unchecked, it's fair to focus on that lens and to say, you need the internet to be a secure communications mechanism so that we can continue to do all the things that you do in that respect. But policies that will work to strengthen the internet against the spread of disinformation will also work in many instances to impede the ability of individuals within countries of repression
yeah.
from expressing themselves. So I'm being vague here. Let me make it a little bit more specific. I have publicly called out on Twitter my concerns with a recent report from the Council of Foreign Relations that declares provocatively at the beginning the end of the era of the global internet. And the motivation for this very bold statement is a belief that internet freedom policy over the past decade plus has failed because Russia, China, and some other countries continue to be very active in their repression and continue to engage in nation-state level disinformation and warfare campaigns. I am extremely concerned about that perspective, not because the factual premise for it is wrong, but because if we lose sight of people within countries of internet repression and their rights and their freedoms. And if we stop focusing on empowering them, we've entered this sort of world of permanent war where it becomes an us versus them. Are you siding with the West or are you siding with the East? And then we get countries in the middle in Africa and Latin America who are asked to look and choose sides. And there's nothing good that will come from any part of this when instead we can shift our entire focus to the lens of the individual and say, let's yes, this is a thing. We can invest in capabilities to try to make sure that individual countries are not harmed by any of this, but we must not forget primacy of the individual and the individual's rights and an emphasis on making sure that every individual person is empowered and has their human rights protected.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'm starting to think that the next question that I had written is actually becoming a bit redundant, but I'm going to kind of just hit at it anyway, because I want to...
We'll catch all the pieces of it we haven't already covered. Exactly. That's cool.
So the piece that you wrote, Modularity for International Internet Governance with Susan Ness. I'm on her email list, so I got it and read it already anyway. Constantinos, just so you know. he wrote the script for this one. So
I love that.
Yeah, no, I mean, this was a great one. I was reading it on the train the other day, and yeah, so you say that fixing the accountability of big platforms is an internet governance issue that democracies need to figure out. I agree.
Yes.
I'm still processing the whole article, and it's a part of our conversation internally at EFF too. But then you go on, you suggest something that I found really interesting. The idea of modularity is a way to improve digital platform accountability through harmonized policies and practices among nations embracing the rule of law. Can you walk me through your thinking there? And as somebody who's worked a lot with people in countries where the rule of law is not embraced, the trickle down, I always hope that the Brussels effect will happen, but I just,
I understand.
Go for it.
and believe me, in the editing process, that phrase countries that follow the rule of law was that was not our first set of words to convey this point in that sentence, as you might imagine. It's a tricky one. So what we're trying to get at with that general construction is, as you approach an international internet law question, where do you look to sort of build a collective norm? Do you do, as is so often the case now, establish it in one specific political jurisdiction, like usually the European Union? The European Union will look at the world, canvas the different collective norms and approaches that are being done, decide what it wants to do, pass a very strong law like the GDPR, and then that will start to trickle out and promulgate as a norm to other countries, accelerated by things like the EU privacy law's requirement for adequacy, which is to streamline the flow of data and commerce and so forth across different borders. The EU has to make a determination that another country's law is good enough on privacy and data protection in order for data for its citizens to be trusted by that other country. While I think that is a mechanism that of necessity does work, I don't think it's optimal as a means of trying to develop an international norm or set of practices. Right. All of this, by the way, to take a half step back, is getting at the problem of a global internet that is being regulated by a number of different countries organized under the Westphalian nation state system, all of which have inherent sovereignty and an inherent authority and legitimacy to take action to protect their citizens and their businesses in various ways. So that's what the UN was for, right? No, the UN is not the forum that we want to look to as a means of developing wide-scale international norms. It's too slow. There are too many perspectives in it that I think run in tension to the values of the internet in particular. Just to go back to the very beginning and this idea that the internet has certain characteristics that we want to seek to preserve. I think if we empower the United Nations and its various bodies with a more explicit or more specific authority to develop or set norms or policies for the internet, we are at grave risk of losing those characteristics that make the internet so unique and so valuable. So what do you do if it's not one of those, right? You could look at a smaller collection of countries like the G7, also excludes all of the developing world. You could look at something like the G20, but it's big enough that it starts to get into that normative question mark space, let's just say. Our thesis with modularity is, get a few countries that are close enough together normatively that they can work on something at a slightly broader and more internationally scalable answer than just one. So if you get the European Union, Canada, the UK, It could be a much broader set than that. It could include Kenya. It could include India. But the point is that you have to start with a smaller group in order to get to the point where you're really answering hard questions through these policy frameworks. And then you build it out and you scale it up from there. This is not, by the way, a universally agreed upon strategy. In our conversations around modularity with a lot of people, we get a lot of feedback of the form of, you really need to draw a bigger and more inclusive tent at the beginning. And we hear that. And there's lots of opportunity, I think, to look at how to be more inclusive in the process of developing this. But we're just worried that the pace of regulation in individual countries is too fast. And so we need to figure out how to hit a happy medium here.
And I think that you're right, Chris. And also that there is not really one approach, right, to do this. I think we need to start becoming a little bit more courageous at experimenting things. And I'm a little bit afraid, even, you know, I was reading again the paper today in light of this episode. And, you know, when you say allies need to come together, automatically I thought, oh my God, you know, 5 years ago, this wouldn't have been even be an issue. And right now we're really struggling to find the ability of two states to sit That's down right. and figure things out. Even the closest of allies, and I'm talking about the US and EU with the data flows. For me,
Absolutely.
This is one of the most, you know, remarkable things that are currently happening.
This month, we've seen the Irish Data Protection Authority declare that standard contractual clauses are no longer sufficient for data transfer. So we're at risk of Facebook not being able to exchange data, and not just Facebook, but a lot of other major companies between the US and Europe. This week, we have the UK and the EU declaring that they're not allowed to coordinate on internet policy matters, including active investigations over fights over the Northern Ireland protocol. Like, this idea of getting allies together and trying to find common ground is actually wildly ambitious right now, even with just a few countries. But I think it needs to be pursued regardless.
And I think that this is going back to, you know, to your whole, to the conversation a little bit we had about China and Russia. These are the gaps that are being identified. And then a lot of these conversations are now getting pushed within the UN system, which sort of gives me a little bit of a segue to change the topic. And, you know, make it a little bit more high level. Let's talk a little bit about internet freedom. I'm going to take you back. You know, when you were at Mozilla, you've spent 7 good years leading public policy there, and you've seen the internet at its sort of greatest, right? Coming out of the Arab Revolution and celebrated for being the tool that brought people together and empowered people to speak up. And then, of course, transitioning into 2016, where, you know, we all knew that the internet could be used as a weapon, but it was right in front of our eyes, right? We just saw it crystal clear. I'm not even going to ask you whether you believe internet freedom is declining, because I really think that all of us here agree that internet freedom is declining. The question.
We don't have to hedge on that.
Right. But my question would be, how can we reverse the trend? Can we reverse the trend? Let's start with that. I am hoping to be an optimist. I am an optimist today.
Me too, right? It's weird.
I know. I'm smiling today, which is a big thing. But can we reverse the trend, Chris? Do you think we can reverse the decline of internet freedom?
Nice, easy questions.
Right, we're just giving you the easy ones. Fine. Well, don't worry, the easy ones are still
coming. I'm stubborn optimist.
And for our audience, may I just say that it's 6 a.m. where you are right now, so you're overperforming
we're going to change the name of the podcast. The Internet of Optimism. Okay, please carry on.
The Internet of Optimism, I love it. No, I have stubborn optimist in my profile in a few places, including, I think, Twitter for a reason. I continue to be a stubborn optimist despite the challenges and stuff that we see. I do believe we can reverse the trend on internet freedom, but I will contend that we're not going to be able to do more than minor improvements in that for so long as the broader political currents of the world are on a trajectory towards authoritarianism and breakdowns of the rule of law, right? Like this, just to get back to this rule of law point that Jillian rightly flagged earlier, rule of law is not a binary. Right. There's no magic club of countries that respect the rule of law and countries that don't. Right. It's very much a line or some more complex geographic geometric shape than that. because nobody is perfect in their celebration of the rule of law. Absolutely no country or no government is. But we're seeing worsening, right? Trajectories towards fewer protections for individual liberties within traditional offline law and governance systems. And little wonder that translates to the online world as well, right? So what do we do to continue to protect internet freedom? Double, triple, and quadruple down on our investments in giving people the technologies that they need to organize and to be in touch with each other and to express themselves, right? Yeah. That is the only thing that we know that we can do in the near term that will have a sustainable positive impact for internet freedom. What does that ultimately do, you know, against the power of a nation state that is committed to asserting its own authoritarian control? I fundamentally believe authoritarian control over the internet is fragile, brittle, and temporary. And while it may work very well for a little while, a house of cards can be beautiful when you stack it up just right too. Eventually, the cracks will grow. And so what we need to do is prize and celebrate those little cracks as we see them happen and find ways to make them bigger and to grow them and to have more of them.
Oh my God, I'm going to steal
this. Am I crying? Are you crying? What's happening right now?
There's a little bit of a tear. I know. I have no idea. But thank you for this.
Thank you. This is
my pleasure.
This is what we needed today. And the sun's coming out here as you speak, which is, I don't know. You brought us sunshine.
How often you get sun and... Yeah, well, sun in Berlin in summer, there's plenty. It's not
some summers, yeah. I mean, this summer has actually been quite hot.
Yeah, fair enough.
Anyway, moving on from that. Do we want to talk about competition, interoperability in the DMA?
I definitely want to talk about competition and interoperability. I'm not an expert on the DMA.
I'm not either.
I've spent some time with it, but okay, fair enough. let me talk a little bit about my history on this issue. And the other thing, just to give it a little context as we dive into it, like, all of these things, internet freedom, user agency, interoperability, this delegation thing, all of this is about empowering individuals, right? And I want to put a big asterisk on that and talk about some of the feedback that I've gotten on that theory of change a little later and why I continue to be a believer in it. But before we get there, interoperability and competition. I had a policy team retreat with the Mozilla policy team in 2016. Actually, let me go 6 months before that. 6 months before that, in the spring of 2016, I was giving a keynote talk at a cloud industry conference. And I was talking about the arc of internet openness and how it felt like on many levels we had won in the net neutrality in the copyright debates. Remember, early 2016, pre-election of Donald Trump, even more optimistic time. Neither of these things are fully settled, of course. But despite the many, many fights that we have and the continued battles that we wage on openness at the telecom layer and openness at the IP layer, I think we're doing all right on those. By and large, continue to need to like hold things where they are. And then at the end of my keynote talk, I said the next step is competition, right? The next step is the growing centralization that we're seeing within the application layer. And at the end of my keynote talk, again, early 2016, I said, and I have no idea what to do about it. Polished it up a little bit more than that. But I didn't have a theory in my head where I could say what I felt like we needed to do in order to address centralization in a way that preserves these key characteristics of the internet, continues to reward investment and create good and positive incentives for individuals and companies along the stack. Fast forward a few months, the Mozilla policy team is sitting around. And at our offsites, we had a sort of thorny questions section. And I'll give credit where credit is due. This was something we inherited from what Yochai Ben-Avi had done at Access Now and ported into our Mozilla retreats. So our thorny question of the time was, what are we going to do about competition? What are we going to try to make Mozilla's presence on competition in this messy landscape? Because none of us really believed, sorry to my friends who deeply believe this, none of us really believed that breaking up companies was the right answer. It doesn't make sense with vertically integrated services in the way that it arguably did with AT&T and more horizontal telecommunication services and so forth. We landed on interoperability as a very pro-internet thing. And I started writing about that in 2017 and have written several articles on the topic since. The value of interoperability is as close as anything to these characteristics that power the internet, because you can't have this low-cost ease and freedom of creation if you can't plug in to what's already there, right? If you can't build on top of the infrastructure and the technologies that you see around you, it's not the internet. It's an existential characteristic and defining feature of the internet. And it's not something that we can take for granted, right? It's something where we see a lot of API policies getting more and more API application programming interface is the common way in which we plug into existing infrastructure. Two paths for interoperability, sorry. Brief technical rail for you. You can achieve interoperability of things working together either through a shared protocol, which is that they speak the same language, then they just talk to each other and it's beautiful and harmonious and everybody sings in the chorus, right? Or via APIs, application programming interfaces, a platform saying, hey, here's my data, here are my services, here's what you need to do in order to talk to me, in order to work with my stuff. And for a long time, the internet was built on protocols, and protocols supported the majority of its conversation, and then there were open APIs, and people could build lots and lots of things. And then we had Cambridge Analytica, which was one of the early open APIs. Facebook, I think, at the time, was trying to do the right thing and offer a really open API that had a lot of data in it. And it turns out you have to be a little more careful than that when you offer an API that has a lot of personal data. Tiny bit more careful. And I don't need to go into that history. If any of your listeners are not familiar with that, they can go read about it by themselves, but I expect most will be. And so it's a complicated question. How do we get to the right level of APIs for availability for encouraging and ensuring that this essential, I like to call it sometimes the secret sauce of the internet, for ensuring that the secret sauce of the internet remains present and viable. And anyway, that's me rambling about
it. No, I love this. I love this so much. I feel like I really just want to ask you, like, because there's so much positivity going on here. Like, is there, I don't know, we didn't really get on the NFTs, but is there anything that you're like cynical about regarding the internet these days?
Oh, I mean, NFTs is a good way to do it. I am cynical about it.
We don't even have to do that. No, it's not necessary.
Before we go on that, I agree with Julia, we need to just put, I mean, really, if you listen to our previous
I feel like we're going to lose listeners. Episodes. They're going to be like, who are these people?
Exactly. Who are these people? I mean, they're so cheery and happy.
What's going on? What's in the Kool-Aid?
In this episode. But before we go there, if I am a little to press a little bit more on interoperability, I really agree with you, and I really think that there is something there for sure. And the DMA also thinks about it as well. I mean, the DMA is mainly premised on the idea of interoperability. But I you know, there have been a lot of people who have said that just screaming interoperability is not going to automatically fix anything, right?
And certainly.
You need to be very much aware of exactly of the way the system. The systems and the business models sort of coexist because interoperability without considering those things can create security issues and can create, you know, competition issues. So when we say interoperability for you, what is the, where do we draw the line, right? Between, okay, this is too much interoperability and right now it's having those negative consequences. Versus this is exactly the amount of interoperability that will allow this healthy competition to sort of happen.
So two things for you. Before I answer that question, I want to talk briefly about the DMA. Yeah. The DMA is not centered around interoperability. It includes an interoperability mandate for messaging services. But for anything higher level than that, I think it dropped the ball. And I don't think it went as far as it would. And the main reason I say that is I was following this process throughout its time. And the European Commission's experts report that was delivered in 2019 used the word interoperability 105 times. I did a control F on it. Like that process had interoperability woven through it. The actual regulations that are included in the DMA are this vast ocean spawning in lots of different directions that in my mind does not really get into interoperability mandates for better or for worse. Obviously the DMA is a very broad, general, vague and powerful instrument and could go in lots of different directions as it gets implemented and interpreted. So I don't want to say it won't do that, but I don't want your listeners walking away thinking that the DMA is principally an interoperability vehicle, because I think that's an inaccurate characterization.
Yes, that is true. It has a huge section on messaging and it certainly has considered it. Yes, you're correct.
But to your point about, you know, what is the right level of interoperability? Like everything else in the policy universe, there is no static answer to that. And so the important question is not what is the optimal answer today, but what are the processes and structures that you design to help adapt and adjust expectations, practices, and principles and behavior on a going forward basis to make sure that we can continue to calibrate outcomes to make them as much in service of the collective set of interests as possible. That leads me back to the modularity conversation. While we are not at this point in time talking about modularity as a tool for everything, we're really focused on the platform responsibility and accountability landscape where we see the most opportunity to do some really concrete good work. It is structures like that that try to bring this early vision of multi-stakeholder internet governance into a more realistic, practical, and actionable frame that give me the answer that I look for when I think, how do we balance interoperability against its other constraints? How do we do it in a specific instance? I don't know. Look at that instance, but not just from the perspective of the platform, not just from the perspective of the user, but from a broad range of perspectives that includes researchers, that includes sometimes government officials working together in a constructive fashion to try to arrive at that answer and recognize that it will change and be a little bit more agile in how you do that, which means you need to step outside the boundaries of laws that are specific in their behavioral guidance because they will break.
Right.
I hope you don't regard that as a cop-out. I think it's actually the only answer that is possible to that question. Even though I think some people regard it as a cop-out, I don't think you can have anything other than a process-based answer to that.
I agree, because we haven't tested anything, so we don't know anything
at this stage.
Yeah.
It goes back to experimenting. We need to experiment, but in order to do that, we need to have the process.
That's right. That's right.
Exactly.
And hopefully learn from our experiments. And not just do the same damn thing over and over again. Sorry, can I swear
on
this?
Yes, you can. Oh, of course. Please. Oh my God. We haven't sworn enough on this podcast today.
which is my problem with the commission currently. I do not object to the idea of experimenting with regulation, but I'm expecting hugely, but I am rejecting totally the idea that when you know it's not working, you don't go back to the drawing board to fix the things that are not working.
Yeah, I think that's right. But that's a problem with governments in every configuration ever across all time. One of the things that I appreciate about the Commission.
So clear-eyed.
So I appreciate about the European Commission. They have shown signs over the past few years of knowing that they don't know everything. And that is rare in the government world. It doesn't always translate to outcomes, but you can see bits and pieces of it there. And so I find some hope in this current European Commission. For their willingness to listen in ways that I have not seen very often from the EU and that I certainly don't see in the current UK political layer, for example, or a lot of others that are setting these norms. So I don't know. That's something, again, stubborn optimist, always looking for the little cracks so we can stretch open a little bit.
I literally need to be calling you once every week to lift me up because I really do not see those cracks currently, but that's because I am tired and I need vacation. So
okay, let me take you to the asterisk, and this is the dark part of this conversation, right? The feedback that I get a lot talking about this delegation idea and this dreamy utopian version of a future in where everyone is empowered. Do we want people to be empowered? Right? A lot of the feedback I get is if you give users control over their recommendation engines, we will accelerate our progress towards the future portrayed in the movie Idiocracy. If anyone in your, have you seen the movie Idiocracy?
Oh yeah.
Okay, oh
yeah.
I think I was just quoting it the other day, but now I've forgotten the quote. Yep.
It's a very poignant vision of the future, 500 years in the future, more. I forget exactly how far the future it is. But it is a increasing stupidification of the human race and this brittle legacy of complex Byzantine technological and legal systems that have been constructed and that nobody knows how to maintain or repair anymore. And it's just a very dark future. So I take fairly the criticism that I get a lot that if we give people more control over their social media experience, for example, that we will just get more and more bile and more hate and more evil. But what's the alternative? Centralizing power and authoritarian control, telling people what they should be doing instead of letting them have agency for it. That alternative is more Orwellian, more quickly than the sort of slow breakdown, I would argue, the movie Idiocracy. I have to believe that we can find something that empowers people and gives them tools, communities, and institutions to slowly correct what the Rand Corporation calls the truth decay, right? The biggest problem facing the entirety, this is grandiose, please forgive me. The biggest problem facing the world and its future right now is the breakdown in objective truth and the breakdown in our ability as a people to acknowledge and recognize truth, right? How we can correct that problem is the most interesting and hardest problem to which I don't have any answers, but you can be sure it will be a large portion of the rest of my career working on how we can bend things to help correct that truth decay problem. Because if we can do that, then we can trust people again, and then we can empower people again. And then while there will always be hate, there will always be darkness on the internet and offline, if we can push it into corners and not have it infect and spread out and tarnish a lot of people, we can get to a better future. So this is all very vague and very high level. Let me make this a little more concrete. I wrote a piece with R Street about a year and a half ago when Parler was taken, you remember Parler? When Parler was kicked out of the Google and the Apple app stores. And I wrote a piece for the Washington Examiner for the conservative DC audience that said, why this kicking Parler out of the app stores is a good thing for the internet. And it's a piece about empowerment and about how we can achieve empowerment that doesn't start at the top with governments, that operates in different layers of it. And a big part of my reason for that is it's not that we can't have people talking about when in the US we have the First Amendment. We allow a great deal of harmful speech that is consistent with our laws here in this country. And we don't need to change that. But what we need to do is limit the ability of radicalized groups to recruit in broader audiences and broader platforms. So if we can sort of let people be and work not at the stage of individual expression, but at the stage of spread, at the place where harm and hate spread out into these broader circles and audiences, I think that's how we can make a little bit of traction here and counter this very common cynicism about individual people and what kinds of choices they will make if empowered in the technology environment. Getting a lot of my deep theories here. This is the first thing in the morning.
Oh my goodness, I love it. I am incapable of being this eloquent so early in the morning, or frankly, even at this time in the afternoon. So, wow. I'm impressed. We are running up against the clock, unfortunately. So we're going to throw our last and fun, most fun, well, I don't even know today if it's the most fun question, but what I think is usually the most fun question at you, which is, what is your favorite internet and human moment?
My favorite internet and human moment.
It can be personal or it can be something that you sort of read but yes.
I'll give you a moment that stood out to me as like the internet is something different. And it's when early in my time as a Twitter user, so this is probably 2008, 2009, I found and followed the Dalai Lama on Twitter. And what I love about that, I mean, I grew up in a classical suburban American conservative Christian, well, not that conservative, I was an Episcopalian, but classical American Christian tradition. But the fact that the Dalai Lama is on Twitter was just really fascinating and mind-boggling to me. It's a new kind of platform. It's a new kind of opportunity to just see and experience that. And it illustrated the open doors and possibilities nature to me in a really interesting way. And I continue to be a big believer in Twitter and a big user of Twitter and a fan of it for its ability to take and highlight positive moments about people. Right. And it's not just the We Rate Dogs account, though the We Rate Dogs account is a must follow. But little instances and moments like that where you can see positivity. I mean, it's hard because not all of those are real. Like, we have to be aware of that and engage with that and responsible humans and how we engage with it. But the opportunities for positivity are there, and they're unique and they're memorable.
That's amazing.
Gorgeous. I love it. Perfect way to end.
Well, yes. Chris, thank you so very much for taking the time to speak to us.
Yeah, Chris, thank you.
Waking up very early in the morning.
So much.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure
talking
with you both as well.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.